Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Hello, welcome to The Rest is History. And we are aware we've probably got lots of new listeners. We've done an episode on Ukraine, haven't we? We've done four episodes on recent history of Russia. And those are episodes that have very much been generated by what is in the news headlines. But we just wanted to tell new listeners that not every episode we do is necessarily prompted by what's going on in the news. And in fact, our aim is very deliberately to sweep as far and wide.
That's right, Tom. We've done everything from Neanderthals to the 1990s. We've done episodes on prehistoric paganism. We've done episodes on the Roman Empire,
the Beatles, on
the dinosaurs, the Beatles, on the oil crisis,
top,
on the
lots of top tens. We've done
top ten
mistresses, top ten most disastrous parties. So something I hope for everybody to taste. And if you are a new listener and you would like to sample some of the other episodes, you'll find links to them. Everything from Alexander the Great to Watergate in the program description. Wherever you get your
that's right. We've got links to some of our most popular episodes. And if you then go back into our feed, you can listen to all the previous episodes. And if you find you like what you hear, you can always join the Rest is History Club at restishistorypod.com. And that is unbelievable value. And you get all kinds of treats and benefits, don't you, Tom?
You get sensational benefits.
You do indeed. Right. We've probably promoted ourselves on our own podcast for long enough. So on with the show.
To Mexico.
Hello, welcome to The Rest is History. In room 44 of the National Gallery in London, there hang the fragments of a large unfinished painting by the French impressionist Edouard Manet, entitled The Execution of Emperor Maximilian. In the centre stand the members of a firing squad, their rifles levelled. On the right, an officer is making the final adjustments to his own rifle. And on the left, well, the only hint of the condemned man is his hand. That's all we see of Maximilian von Habsburg-Lothringen, Emperor of Mexico. The rest of him is missing. And Tom Holland, there is a metaphor there, isn't there, for the extraordinary, colourful, strange story of this ill-fated man.
It is. And, do you know, I mean, I kind of vaguely had an awareness of it, principally, I have to say, through the Manet painting. And reading up about him and discovering more about him, it actually reminds me a bit of General Gordon.
Yes, there's definite
you know,
General
there's,
Gordon.
There's, so the plot is, I mean, this is a guy who is a Habsburg Archduke, and he goes off to Mexico, and I don't think we're giving any spoilers. Well, no spoilers, because you've already given it away. I mean, he ends up in front of a firing squad. So there is a kind of slight parallel with Gordon, except that this story has a distinctively Latin American quality.
Yes.
And it comes across absolutely brilliantly in a new book, The Last Emperor of Mexico, by Edward Shawcross, which I thought, I mean, it has... I don't know if you've ever read the Louis de Bernier novels that he wrote before Captain Corelli. They're a kind of riff on the theme of Latin American magical realism. Yeah. You know, so Thomas Aquinas turns into a hummingbird, that kind of stuff. it's and this story is so odd, it's so bizarre, it's so kind of baroque.
It's very magical realist, isn't it?
And it's so brilliantly told that it is a great privilege for us to have the author with us on the show. Ed, thanks so much for joining us. We both enjoyed this book so much. And it is an amazing story. And as I said, you know, this is a story that probably isn't widely known. So let's kick off with a question from Harry Lloyd Prentice, who asks, who was the last emperor of Mexico?
Oh, well,
for now.
That's true. Well, thank you for that fantastic introduction. So the last emperor of Mexico is Ferdinand Maximilian, and he's a Habsburg. But of course, he's the younger brother, or a younger brother, of Franz Joseph, the emperor of Austria. Now, Maximilian is a man who's absolutely convinced of his destiny to rule. And it's only by an accident of birth that he's not the one who's going to be in charge of the Austrian Empire. Now, Maximilian, he's an interesting character and very different from his brother. They're very close when they're young. But when Franz Joseph becomes Emperor of Austria in 1848, the characteristics that that separate them become more important. So Franz Joseph, very autocratic, rigid and conservative. Maximilian, much more outgoing, gregarious and liberal. And what do you do with a younger brother who's outgoing, gregarious and liberal? You keep him far from power.
So that description of the slightly rigid, dutiful elder brother who goes on to attain a royal position on the throne, and the slightly dreamier younger brother who ends up going to America. Dominic, does that remind you of...
Tom and James Holland, right?
It's William and Harry, isn't it?
Oh, really? I would never have guessed. Yeah, but the difference is that, well, we'll explore some of the differences. But yes, so just to put this into context, Maximilian was born in 1832, I think, so 2 years younger than Franz Joseph. Is that about right?
That's absolutely right, yeah.
Franz Joseph... Yeah, the Habsburgs are not quite what they were, but Franz Joseph still rules this sort of great patchwork of Central Europe, including a bit of Northern Italy. And meanwhile, so Mexico, I suppose, and the Spanish Empire had once been a Habsburg possession, but obviously that's a long time in the past. And what's going on in Mexico? I mean, why on earth would an Austrian end up in Mexico, Ed?
But that's an excellent question. So to take us to Mexico, it becomes independent, unlike most other Latin American nations, as a monarchy. A Spanish royalist changes sides, joins the independence movement, fights against the Spaniards, and manages to unite the disparate forces fighting against Spain. Now, he does that with this plan, which is that Mexico should become a monarchy ruled by a member of the Spanish royal family. The Spanish king, Ferdinand VII, who I think has got to be one of the most incompetent monarchs of the 19th century, and that's a highly competitive field, yeah. refuses point blank to accept this plan whatsoever. So you're presented with a problem. You have a monarchy, but you don't have a monarch. Iturbide, the Spanish royalist officer who's changed sides, his solution is he crowns himself emperor. So Mexico does become an empire. There's a first Mexican empire, but it's disastrous. His reign is short, 9 months. He's very quickly deposed, goes off into exile. Actually comes back in 1824, expecting to be welcomed as a hero. He's not. He's arrested and then executed for treason. So that's the first emperor of independent Mexico. Now, after that, Mexico is plagued by instability. It does become a republic, but violence much more important than the ballot box in determining who holds power. And if you want a Sisyphean task, try and memorise every single Mexican president from 1824 to 1861. If you include the interim presidents and the presidents who are not recognised by other presidents, it's near impossible. So you have what we might call, anachronistically, a failed state in Latin America. But so far, apart from that beginning with monarchy, not that different to the fate of many other Latin American republics. What also sets Mexico apart is its proximity to the United States of America. And as a later president of Mexico famously says, poor Mexico, so far from God, so close to the United States. And nowhere would that have been more apparent than in 1846. United States of America declares war on Mexico. It's a nakedly expansionist drive to dominate the North American continent. In just over a year, US troops march up from Veracruz, the main Atlantic port of Mexico, and occupy the magnificent city, the capital, Mexico City, unfurling the stars and stripes across this glorious main square with the Catholic cathedral looming over them. Now, they only leave at an extraordinary high price. The Mexican government gets $15 million, which was nothing then, bearing in mind that what the United States of America is going to get. They're going to get half of Mexico's national territory. So this is places today like California, for example. And in return, US troops will end the occupation and a peace treaty is signed. So you not only do you have political instability, you have national humiliation and trauma. And in the 1850s, things don't improve. There's a civil war between two rival factions, very loose political parties, liberals and conservatives. The liberals are led by Benito Juarez. And their argument as to why Mexico is in the situation it is that it's not liberal enough. It's not secular enough. They need to...
And Ed, Juarez is actually, he's indigenous, isn't he? So he's not of Spanish descent.
Yes, he's from indigenous peoples of Mexico, Zapotec, just outside of Oaxaca, which is southeast Mexico.
So he comes from an incredibly humble background.
Oh, absolutely. He's an extraordinary figure. And as we'll see throughout this story, he's someone who, you know, he stays with it for the whole duration and, of course, stays with it for longer than Maximilian in the end. He's an extraordinary figure, determined on self-improvement. So if you read his sort of own notes, his own kind of autobiographical notes, he talks about how he wanted to learn Spanish because Spanish wasn't his first language in this indigenous community that he grew up in the foothills and the mountains, very desolate. So he wanted to learn Spanish to better himself. And his uncle was one of the few people who spoke Spanish. So sort of after toiling all day in the field, he would go to his uncle's house and he wasn't making sufficient progress in his studies. So he used to take a whip and he would ask his uncle to beat him to improve his Spanish. What the story that Benito Juarez tells
Tougher
you.
Than Duolingo, isn't
that's
it?
Very, that's very Gladstonian behaviour.
So you've got this extraordinarily determined individual in Benito Juarez, and he comes to power. Well, it's not him in power in 1855, but it's his party, and it's a group of much more radical liberals determined to break the power of the Catholic Church, which is not only has an enormous spiritual hold over Mexico, but is the biggest landowner, is the principal economic powerhouse. And so the key reform here is they nationalize church property and sell it on the open market, as you know, any good liberal will, which has two happy effects of that. One, you break the power of the Catholic Church, and two, you enrich the coffers of the government treasury. Now, for the other faction, the conservatives, the reason why Mexico has been humiliated and is politically unstable is not because it's not liberal enough, but because it's gone too far in that direction. And the only thing they argue that meaningfully binds Mexico together as a nation state is Catholicism. So you have a bitter divide over to the future of Mexico. Long story short, Benito Juarez's liberals win. They enter the capital in triumph in 1861. Conservatives are defeated and they flee, many of them in exile. Benito Juarez holds elections and becomes the constitutional president of Mexico. But those exiles never accept, and actually many conservatives still in Mexico never accept that result. Shock, horror. Who would have accepted the shock? I know. Disgraceful behaviour in the 19th century.
So to put this into context, Ed, you just said 1861. So 1861 is the year of the outbreak of the American Civil War. So at this point, the big sort of bullying neighbour to the north is absorbed by its own problems, because, of course, actually now to the north of Mexico, it's the Confederate States of America fighting the Civil War against the Union. Now, the other issue, I guess, is, am I right in thinking there's that the major problem for Mexico is indebtedness? It's a problem of so many countries in what we would now call the developing world in the 19th century. They've run up colossal debts to Europe, largely to European sort of lenders, haven't they?
They have. And the Mexican government particularly took out a series of loans in the 1820s, which they never paid back. And the principal debtor to the nation to whom they owe the debt is actually Britain. But they have also money which they owe to France and which they owe to Spain. Now, given the political history of Mexico, given the US-Mexican war and the civil war that we've just described, the treasury is not overflowing, you won't be surprised to hear. So what Benito Juarez does as an emergency measure is he suspends foreign debt payment. He asks, well, he doesn't ask, he declares it, and Congress declares 2 years without paying foreign debt. Now, in the mid-19th century, that kind of behaviour has a pretty quick response from European powers, which is military intervention.
Right. So we have, on the one hand, a man of peasant background, indigenous, didn't even learn to speak Spanish, hauled himself up from his bootstraps, who's become president of a liberal but massively indebted Mexican Republic. On the other hand, we've already introduced him, Maximilian the Archduke, one of the long line of Habsburgs, one of the probably the most famous royal dynasty in the whole of Europe. Now, the person who brings them together, who binds their fates together.
I think we can say the villain of this podcast, Tom.
Would he be, by any chance, a Frenchman?
He is. He is a Frenchman. In some ways, a quintessential Frenchman, in other ways, not. This is Napoleon III, nephew of the more famous Napoleon, and a man, similarly, we've got quite a few people in the story convinced of their destiny. Napoleon III is convinced that he is the man who will lead France back to greatness, and more importantly, lead himself to greatness and restore his uncle's empire in some form, which he does manage to do, despite several failed attempts in the 1830s and 1840s. He's actually the first ever democratically elected president of France, happens to be a Bonaparte, Louis Napoleon Bonaparte. I should say it's universal male suffrage in this case. The problem he has is that the Second Republic, the regime that he is now president of, has a constitution which prohibits him being re-elected. So he does what any self-respecting Bonapartist would do, launches a coup d'etat against his own government, and a year later, in 1852, declares himself Emperor of the French.
Yeah, that's so Napoleonic. And so presumably he is self-consciously following in the footsteps of his uncle.
I think he wakes up every day and asks himself, what would my uncle have done? And tries to do some kind of version of it. But what's important as well about that that moment in 1851 where he launches the coup d'etat is that what he has done there is he has destroyed a republic, and on the ashes of that republic created an empire, a monarchy. Mm-hmm. This is where the famous Karl Marx quote comes, the first time as tragedy, the second time as farce. If people have heard of Napoleon III, it's often through that Karl Marx quote talking about the coup. But in the 1850s, there's not very much farcical at all about his regime. In fact, the economy booms, the foreign policy is a success, he allies with Britain in fighting the Crimean War, they invade northern Italy in 1859, defeating Franz Joseph, and it seems as though he's ended France's isolation, restored France to greatness to some extent, and has created a domestically stable political system. So this is something that monarchists and conservatives in Mexico take a look at. And they have the ear of Napoleon III through his wife, the Empress Eugenie. Their pitch to him is to make Mexico great again, to coin a phrase. You need to return to the original idea of independence, which is monarchy. And so they tell Napoleon III it's going to be incredibly easy. All we would need is a few thousand French troops. We'll turn up there, we'll declare the plan, which is to restore Mexico to its original state of monarchy. Mexican conservatives who have been defeated by Juarez will flock to the banner. And Benito Juarez, you may say he's a liberal, actually he's a despot. It's a radical minority oppressing the silent majority of Mexicans who will, once Maximilian turns up, acclaim him as emperor.
Right, Napoleon. Now, what's in it for him? Because obviously France, you know, it hasn't been a great colonial power in Latin, what we now think of as Latin America and South America, Central America, or the bottom bit of North America. Is he thinking he can carve out a new French-American empire? Or is he after the natural resources? Does he just want his debts paid? Or is it just about press? What is it? What does he think he's going to get?
It's a mixture of all of those things, in fact. But one thing that's interesting to flag here is he does have incredibly grand vision for Latin America. And that term...
Well, he comes up with the term, doesn't he?
He doesn't come up with the term, but the term is first coined in Paris in the 1850s. Right. And there's a bit of dispute about who said what and when. But it's mid-1850s. It's in Paris where this idea of Latin America bubbles up and begins to get expressed. One vision of Latin America, which is one that Napoleon III is sympathetic to, is this idea of southern countries with the Catholic tradition and culture have an affinity with the southern European Catholic countries. And of course, the most powerful southern European Catholic country is France. So Latin America, and it's that term Latin is in opposition to Anglo-Saxon, northern United
right.
States of America, right?
Yeah.
And the reason why it becomes coined in the 1850s is because you're demarcating an area of influence for France that is in opposition to further US aggression, because no one in the 1850s thinks that US expansion is going to stop where it
right.
stops.
But the US have proclaimed the Monroe Doctrine, though, haven't they? So they basically said, the US have publicly said they don't want European powers, you know, involved in the Western Hemisphere anymore. But Napoleon still thinks he can get away with it. He thinks kind of sod the US. They've got their own troubles about slavery. I can just ignore them. Is that basically, I mean, or am I being too simplistic?
No, not at all. And it's precisely because of the US Civil War that Napoleon III is able to try and put his vision into practice. Because torn apart with the conflict between Union and Confederacy, the Monroe Doctrine, which is incredibly popular, actually, and that sort of nationalist cornerstone of foreign policy, it's not just in the corridors of power where it's discussed. It's something that you can get up on and talk about in elections and people cheer. They cannot risk, antagonizing the French and getting the French involved into the Civil War, potentially recognizing the Confederacy, worse still, offering some kind of mediation or perhaps even getting involved militarily. So the Monroe Doctrine, interesting, Lincoln doesn't use the phrase Monroe Doctrine once from 1861 to 1865.
Well, because Eddie, in your book, you describe this, this episode as the greatest challenge to the Monroe Doctrine until the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is, that's quite something. It gives you a sense of the kind of geopolitical stakes that are involved in what might seem an almost kind of opera bouffe kind of episode.
But I completely agree and I stand by that. And this French intervention, monarchy, Catholicism on the borders of the United States of America. I mean, this is the very nightmare that everyone's sort
Habsburgs.
Of Habsburgs turning up on your doorstep. I mean, this is the horror.
So, exactly. So you say Tom says Habsburgs. Napoleon needs a candidate. He doesn't think of picking. I mean, I tell you what his uncle would have done, Ed. His uncle would have picked one of his family. Why doesn't Napoleon do that?
Of course, and he's got plenty. There are loads of Bonapartes lying around. That's part of the reason why they keep coming back. So I think even for a man as self-obsessed with the Bonapartist myth as Napoleon III, he feels that that's one sort of area of policy in which he shouldn't emulate his uncle. And it's also a sense because he is trying to we'll see this when we get into what he creates. The independence of Mexico is central to the idea. Now whether there is any independence or not, something we can discuss later. But having a half brother or a cousin or whatever on the throne of Mexico is not a strong look. So that's not an option for him. Bonaparte's relations with the French royal houses is, of course, not brilliant. So you can't have a French monarch. And the some of the sort of ultra conservative Mexicans wouldn't mind a Spanish monarch. But even with their limited horizons, they're aware that the sort of toxic legacy of Spanish colonialism means that's a hard sell. But also, if you're if you're looking for a monarch in the 19th century, the name Habsburg is the illustrious one that sort of stands out above all others. And so, if you could get a Habsburg on board, that would be a fantastic for the project. And of course, the connection as well with the 16th century, it's under Emperor Charles V, also King of Spain, that Mexico is first subjugated and brought under the Spanish Empire. So you have that legacy as well.
And Ed, not to be reductive, but also Maximilian looks like an emperor, right? I mean, he's a tall, impressive-looking guy with a great big forked beard. But obviously the look of the whole business is going to be very important. I mean, there's a slight element of smoke and mirrors about the whole concept.
Which, of course, is a huge part of monarchy and indeed a huge part of Maximilian's life. I mean, he's obsessed with the minutiae of detail and etiquette, but also the outward appearance of monarchy. Absolutely, he does. He fits the role. And the other reason is that he's available, because, as we said earlier, he's been sidelined by his brother, Franz Joseph. And if we are going to make the Harry connection, then...
Who is Meghan?
Every Harry needs their Meghan. So enter Maximilian's Meghan. She's Princess Charlotte. Now, she's better known to Mexican history as Carlota. But she's the daughter of the Belgian king, Leopold I, and her mother's side related to the kings and queens of France. So and to push the Meghan analogy further, she, by virtue of being a Belgian princess, she's not someone who is on an equal footing with the Habsburgs. Now, Maximilian's been sent on one of these sort of various pointless diplomatic missions that his brother likes to get him on because it gets him out of Austria and away from the centre of power. And he's very dismissive of going to the Belgian court. He thinks it's disgusting that someone like him should have to go to a monarchy which was only created in 1831. Yeah. A year before he was born. So it's hard
for parvenus, the Belgians. Yeah.
Hard for us to take it seriously. And when he's there, he goes to one of these balls and he says it's awful because the elite of the country are sort of mixing and talking with their tailors and their cobblers. And it's the kind of thing that shouldn't be allowed to happen. One thing he does like, though, is Princess Charlotte Carlotta.
Well, do you know, I'm not surprised because, Dominic, did you pick up on this, that her favourite subjects when she was age 12?
Remind me, Tom.
Religion and Plutarch.
Oh my God, it's like
what a girl! What a girl!
Tom Holland. What a nightmarish image.
Like marry her like a shot.
Which is exactly what Maximilian thinks, and indeed then does. Within months, they're married. And she's fiercely ambitious herself. But obviously, as an aristocratic woman in the 19th century, she needs a husband for a meaningful political role.
And she has a sense of destiny, doesn't she? Like everybody on this story. She
Everyone has a sense of destiny.
God has picked her for some unspecified purpose. Is that right?
Mm. She's incredibly pious and incredibly Catholic. And very much buys into that vision of providence is the word that she always uses. And part of the condition, the Leopold I agrees to it on the proviso that Franz Joseph gives Maximilian a position of power, a meaningful position of power, and that is governor of Lombardy, Venetia, which is one of the richest parts of the Austrian Empire at this time in northern Italy. But it's a poison chalice because the forces of Italian nationalism make this an incredibly difficult job for anyone to do well and succeed in. So it's very much, you wanted a position of power, well, here you go, try this. Even then, Franz Joseph is quite careful to keep real power in Vienna and away from Maximilian. And within 2 years, Napoleon III, who had a sort of youthful romantic love of Italian nationalism, backs Piedmont, invades northern Italy with 200,000 troops and defeats Franz Joseph in northern Italy. Franz Joseph has, at the sort of weeks before, sacked Maximilian as well, very humiliatingly. So what you have by the end of the 1850s and certainly beginning of the 1860s is you have Maximilian and Carlotta, who are underemployed, underappreciated, but both convinced that they have a much greater destiny.
And so to put this into, just to absolutely nail this down, they have never been to Mexico.
Never.
They don't speak Spanish.
Well,
not at this point. Sure.
No, not fluently. Not fluently.
So they're not fluent Spanish speakers. They've never crossed the Atlantic.
Maximilian has actually. He's been to Brazil. Yeah, after he gets sacked as governor of Lombardy, Venetia, Maximilian loves to travel. That sort of wanderlust, traveling the globe to the exotic, and very sort of Alexander von Humboldt-esque is his. Would be one of his great heroes.
But he's not been to North America.
Right? No, he's not. No, Brazil is a very long way away from Mexico.
I've been to a Brazilian restaurant.
Yes,
but
it's
I wouldn't
not great
to become
a job in Brazil. Go on. Have you been to Mexico? Well, no, I have been to Brazil though.
Yeah, that's his pitch. So obviously it's a brilliant idea.
To them, it does seem like a brilliant idea. It does.
And so basically he signs up to it. Carlotta signs up to it. And they decide that they will go. They accept this. I think we should take a break at this point. And when we come back, we should look at the story of what actually happens when Maximilian and Carlotta set sail for their kingdom.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Tom, excellent news. Sponsors Unheard, that's UNHERD, the online magazine that pushes back against herd mentality and encourages independent thinking. They are back.
Hooray.
It's great news, isn't it?
That's fantastic news. And what are they publishing imminently, Dominic?
Well, Tom, I hate to blow my own trumpet. Actually. I don't hate it at all. I love it. So I have just written a piece for them about, it was their idea, actually. It was Jacob Ferrady's idea, one of the editors at Unheard. And he said it was the 75th anniversary, on I think March the 12th, of the promulgation of the Truman Doctrine. Do you know what that is, the Truman Doctrine?
No.
Okay, well, I'll tell you. And this is why you have to read Unheard, Tom.
Yes.
So Harry Truman, little man, former haberdasher from Kansas City, whose shop went bust after 2 years, is catapulted into the U.S. presidency in 1945.
So that's when Roosevelt dies.
When Roosevelt dies. And then there's that sort of muddy period at the end of the Second World War and the beginning of the Cold War. And then in 1947, he gets up in front of a joint session of Congress and he basically says, we're in a global conflict with the Soviet Union. We're going to give loads of money to Greece and Turkey to stave off communism. We can't allow them to fall to communism. And then basically we've got a new policy, which is containing communism wherever it is. We're not fighting it militarily, but using economic, political, and cultural pressure to draw a line between the free world and the totalitarian world. And it'll be a long struggle, and one day we'll win.
And so, Dominic, when you wrote this, were you aware of any contemporary potential?
I was, of course. And this was very much in, because, Tom, we're in the not dissimilar position to the one Truman was in 47. So Stalin didn't have nuclear weapons at that point. They were 2 years away. But, you know, the Red Army was massive and fighting Stalin would have meant millions of casualties. So the Americans and the British didn't want to do it. But they actually had a contingency plan, but they knew that it would be incredibly costly. So the same sort of deterrent was still there. And I think you could argue that Truman's genius and Clement Attlee in Britain and Ernest Bevin, the founders of NATO, was that they said basically it'll be a long campaign, very grueling, and it means, in a way, condemning a lot of people to live under communism in regimes they don't want, in a world of lies and all that sort of stuff. But in the long run, we can do it and it will be worth it. So I think there is a good lesson there, actually.
Okay. People should obviously read your article and go to unheard.com, UNHERD.
Yeah, very good.
But do you draw any optimistic conclusions?
Yes, I do.
Or I do. Okay,
say
no more, Dominic.
I say at the end of this, I'll tell you what I'd say, Tom. I will tell you what I'd say.
Okay.
I will have my say. I say Harry Truman has already seen off Lenin and Stalin. Even in death, he can see off Vladimir Putin as well.
Well, there is a thought. And if you would like to read articles of a similar quality to Dominic's, in what I'm sure is the ongoing campaign that all of us are engaged in to stave off herd mentality, you go to unheard.com, UNHERD. And if you are a Rest is History listener,
/rest,
you type in /rest and you get 3 months for free.
Yeah. And normally, Tom, it is
£1 a week, isn't it?
A week. I mean, that's good value in itself, but to have it for free is extraordinary.
That's just, yeah. And often absolutely not to be missed. So many thanks to Unheard. And now let's get back to whatever it is we're talking about. They're going to Mexico, which I cannot understand. That was Queen Victoria commenting on Maximilian and Carlotta.
That was very Liam Neeson, straight creepy boy, I thought, actually, Tom, but there you go.
It was Queen Victoria. Everyone would know that was Queen Victoria. I mean, obviously, you're Queen Victoria. They are going to Mexico, which I cannot understand. But enough of that. Ed, we have Maximilian and Carlotta are heading off to Mexico. And this is a Mexico that has basically been, it's under French occupation. Is that right? Or most of it is. The central part of it is.
That's a good way of describing it, Tom. So the reason why Napoleon III had accepted it and Maximilian Carlotta too is because it thought that it would be fairly easy to put into practice. In fact, it's a massive undertaking that requires regime change. So Napoleon III, in 1862, he only sends 6,000 troops. And that's how easy he thinks it's going to be to work his way up from Veracruz to Mexico City and the overland route, same route that the conquistadors.
And is that because he's kind of influenced by the story of Cortez conquering the Aztecs? I mean, is this this kind of idea that it's really easy to conquer Mexico City?
That looms so large in the minds of the soldiers and in the mind of Napoleon III. All I would say as a caveat to that is that the US expeditionary force that fights its way along exactly the same route, there's only one route to Mexico City from Veracruz, right, that you're going to take, is only about 12,000 men. So Napoleon III sent half that, but what he thinks will happen is that Mexican monarchists, Mexican conservatives will rally to the French flag. And therefore, he's got much more support than the United States of America had. So it's part delusion, but partially based on what he thinks happened, a few decades ago or a couple of decades ago of that. These 6,000 troops, they're on their way to Mexico City. And to get there, you have to go past Mexico's great second city, Puebla. And the French commander is incredibly confident because, remember, this is the French army that defeated the Russians in Crimea, defeated the Austrians in 1859. And so he deploys before this city, magnificent with churches and convents. You'd love it, Tom. And gives the order for wave after wave of French troops just to attack frontal assault onto the city. But they are cut down by the heroic resistance of Benito Juarez's army, which, of course, has remained loyal to the constitutional president rather than rallying to the flag of a French invader. So that's just to give, and that, sorry, by the way, I should say that goes down in history as Cinco de Mayo, because that's on the 5th of May.
It's a Mexican national holiday, isn't it? I mean,
it's a big deal, but it's often mistaken for Mexican independence. It's not, it's actually celebrating this victory at the Battle of Puebla. So that gives you an indication of how difficult the situation is. And so difficult is it that pacification, which is the euphemism the French use for their brutal counterinsurgency tactics, it takes another year for them to get to Mexico City. And it takes yet another year for Maximilian and Carlota to make the voyage across to Mexico. So they don't get there until May 1864.
And Ed, there are some hilariously badly behaved Frenchmen in this story. So there's this diplomat Dubois de Saligny, who's, he seems the worst diplomat in diplomatic history. I mean, his chief talent seems to be for offending people. There's a general Foiret, who is so fat that a chair collapses under him. And then there's this terrifying colonel whose kind of counterinsurgency record is reminiscent of the Battle of Algiers. I mean, this is it's not a kind of dream team, is it? For a French dream team in terms of nation building.
It's not a dream team for nation building at all. No, and the counterinsurgency colonel Charles Dupin is an extraordinary figure, sort of the reverse of General Gordon. Although actually, perhaps not in one way, but one of his fellow French officers said of Dupin, he had all the vices known to man, except for drink. But actually, I think that makes him slightly more terrifying because he's put in charge of counterinsurgency. He was actually thrown out of the French army, not for looting the Summer Palace in Beijing. So he was in the Opium Wars, of course he was. Mexico is a conflict that drags in the dregs and soldiers of fortune and various imperialist ventures. Now unlike General Gordon, he was leading the charge. He's literally one of the first in and first out with as much loot as he could. He then went back to Paris and just openly sold it, which even for the Second Empire, Napoleon III, was considered corruption too much. So he was kicked out of the French army. But when he heard they were going to Mexico, he wrote to Napoleon III and said, "Well, this is the kind of place I excel in." And Napoleon III essentially backs him and gets him off to Mexico, where he sets up this counter-guerrilla unit to defeat the forces of Benito Juarez, who've never surrendered, by the way. Benito Juarez is just retreating northwards from Mexico City after the French take the capital. And this is an extraordinary letter that he writes to his niece, where he says, "I have waged an atrocious war. If I were Mexican, what hatred I would have for the French and how I would make them suffer." I think, why would you write that to your niece? I like to see what she wrote back.
Thanks for the necklace. Enjoyed your thoughts about the war.
But the serious point is, as Tom says, if you're trying to win over hearts and minds, to use the phrase that would probably be used today in this kind of foreign intervention, having someone who is burning down villages, summarily executing people suspected of aiding Benito Juarez, and generally causing all kinds of trouble is not necessarily the person that you want. And so Maximilian has that problem. How do you win over a population that is potentially hostile anyway, and even more so when they've borne the brunt of the French army?
But Ed, the amazing thing is that Maximilian is kind of oblivious to this, isn't he? Because Napoleon has said to him, if I remember this right from the book, Napoleon has said, everybody in Mexico is absolutely on board with you arriving, and it's only a tiny minority who are making a fuss. And also Napoleon has said, crucially, the British are completely on board with this and they'll support you as well, which is an outright lie. The British have already said, haven't they? We're not going to intervene. We're not going to bail you out if it goes wrong. But Maximilian, is it self-delusion or is he genuinely deluded by the French?
I think it's a bit of both. I think that he wants to be misled. So Napoleon III does spin an incredibly elaborate diplomatic game. And he's Napoleon III is a man who loves conspiracies and back channels and smoke-filled rooms. And so this is a fantastic opportunity for him to really put that into practice. He absolutely misleads Maximilian about the popularity of monarchy in Mexico, and he completely deceives him about the British view. And the British is interesting, but slightly ambivalent, because although Palmerston is prime minister at this time, and although no lover of the French, he's absolutely no lover of the United States of America. And so when this plan's put to him, he says, well, it will cost tens of millions of pounds, and we'd have to send 20,000 troops. No way Britain would do that. But if France wants to push back the power of the United States of America for us, we shouldn't, that would be fantastic. So actually, Russell, his foreign secretary, wants to write a letter to Maximilian, because Maximilian's condition of accepting the crown is British support. And Palmerston says, no, don't write the letter. Keep it ambiguous. Maximilian, he is misled, but there's sort of a lot of intrigue going on, which is probably, it's slightly above anything that he would be able to comprehend.
But Ed, you have a brilliant passage in your book where you describe how Maximilian, Carlotta and all their gang come from Veracruz to Mexico City. And they all have to kind of get off a train and get picked up by mules. And you describe it, this caravan presented an extraordinary sight. The elite of Habsburg society dressed in the finest European fashions, driven towards the capital by local muleteers clothed in leather jackets, goatskin trousers and wide gold-trimmed sombreros. And that's what I mean about the kind of magical realist quality, because it's the conjunction of these two fabulously remote and different worlds coming together that just kind of seems to generate. I mean, it's a kind of tragicomedy, isn't it?
Don't they have they have hundreds of base pieces of luggage? I mean, they basically brought everything with them. And they've also brought, am I right in thinking they brought their own personal orchestra conductor?
You can't be an emperor without that.
I mean, they just have clearly no clue. Ed, are we being too harsh?
Billiards tables.
Billiard tables, exactly. The
brilliant thing that if a guest loses, Maximilian forces him to crawl under the table as a forfeit. But if Maximilian loses, then a servant does it for him. Yeah. I mean, this is quality emperorship.
It is, isn't it? So there are many reasons that Maximilian is not necessarily the man for the job, because he's faced with an extraordinary situation and difficult problems, and to overcome them would require a man of equally extraordinary ability. And there are elements to him which, as you say, lend themselves to farce. And one of them is his obsession with etiquette and court ceremony, hence why you need to have your orchestra with you, because you need to have the right music playing at the right time. So on the long sea voyage over to Mexico, where you think that he might, in fact, be reading up on the history and politics of the country he's about to rule, he actually spends most of his time writing a 600-page guide to the etiquette that will be followed at his court.
It's so important.
That's the thing. But so you can't, his enemies, of course, they wouldn't. It's absurd that he's worried about, what shoes to wear. But the other thing in this course is that etiquette is incredibly important to monarchy. And as Tom was saying earlier, partially it is the image, it's the pomp and the ceremony. And there is no court in Mexico because it's a republic. So in order for that to be established, it has to be created. And monarchy, it so much depends, doesn't it, on that outward appearance of sort of grandeur and majesty.
But Ed, there's a paradox, isn't there, about Maximilian, which is that although we're making him sound a kind of very stiff, pompous, faintly foolish figure, and although he's been sponsored by Napoleon III, and although he's been backed by the monarchists, in fact, he's a very, very liberal figure. I mean, and not just by the standards of the Habsburgs. I mean, by anybody's standards. And he brings in a whole range of remarkably progressive laws, among which, am I right, he's the first person to introduce a legally guaranteed lunch break?
I'm not sure whether he's the first person, but
that is a Corbynite measure,
isn't it? He does. He takes incredible. But again, it sort of backfires to him. So you're absolutely right. He is liberal and very progressive by the standards of the day. But of course, the people who have called him to rule over him are these Mexican Catholic conservatives who want to restore the power of the church. Now, that's anathema to Maximilian's way of thinking. And part of the reason why he became so distant to Franz Josef was exactly because he disagreed over these kind of policies. So when he comes to Mexico, conservatives are expecting, the sort of ultra-mundane Catholic monarch and autocracy. And what they get is a slightly watered-down version of Benito Juarez's liberalism. He confirms that key policy that Benito Juarez had been fighting for, the nationalisation of church property, to the horror of his own allies. So what he does...
Is that because he genuinely believes that's the right thing to do? Or is it because actually he's politically astute enough to recognise that he has to do that if he wants to keep the foundations for his regime?
But Tom, I don't think it is astute. You see, now, regular listeners will expect this from me. Is there not an argument, Ed, that Maximilian could have prevailed if he'd just been... If he'd really gone all out with all in with the Conservatives, if he'd basically been more partisan and less liberal.
A question from Peter Edmund: would the Emperor Maximilian have been more successful had he been less liberal? Would a fully reactionary monarch, Sandbrook style, have had a better chance?
The dream of authoritarians everywhere. It's a really interesting question. I think in terms of counterfactuals. Dealing with that point first. The thing about, I think actually he is a genuine liberal, but he's also, we've painted him as slightly a buffoonish figure, but he's also doing something pragmatic here. If the Mexican conservatives had been powerful enough to achieve what they wanted to achieve, they would have done it. They lost the civil war and they need the help of France in order to create this monarchical regime. That conservative project has failed. Now, he does alienate his conservative allies, but when push comes to shove, they are going to back him, right, if necessary, and as we see, they do. The people who will not back him, even moderate liberals, will not back a reactionary government in Mexico. And therefore, winning over the Juaristas is something that he genuinely believes is the right thing. He is a moderate liberal, but also is something that might give his empire a much firmer base for the long term. There's another constraint, though, which is, in fact, Napoleon III, because Napoleon III is very keen not to be seen as reactionary himself. And he refuses to allow, he wouldn't have allowed the Conservatives to overturn the nationalisation of church property, because that was actually one of the foundational resolutions of the 1789 resolution in France. And Napoleon III, although we think of him as autocratic and dictatorial, he himself saw himself as ploughing a sort of middle road between liberalism and conservatism. So there are also constraints on Maximilian. I think that's a good one. I think it would have to be combined with something else, and it's that this has to work and happen in 1862. By 1864, you've only got 1 year until the end of the American Civil War. And so that geopolitical space to carve out a monarchy on the borders of the United States of America is quickly vanishing.
So what Maximilian has got into, basically, is a situation of an incredibly narrow time window, colossal constraints, his foreign patron, the issues on the ground, all this stuff, and also the fact, I mean, do you not think, though, Ed, he is totally out of his depth, isn't he? I mean, this is a kind of situation that he's never, ever had to deal with as Franz Josef's younger brother when he was running the Austrian Navy or whatever. I mean, all this stuff about sort of rebranding himself as the champion of the indigenous people and dressing as a cowboy and whatnot. I mean, these are all, they're bound to fail, aren't they? Or am I being too harsh?
Well, but isn't also, I mean, he's gone in there to, he's under an obligation to Napoleon III to pay back this debt that has been kind of ticking away.
I mean, that's never going to be popular, is it?
No, well, of course. And I think the other thing to bear in mind is his opponent, that man we talked about earlier, Benito Juarez, who is absolutely determined that he will never give in to the forces of European imperialism, monarchy, and ultimately Maximilian's back as conservatism. In fact, Benito Juarez, his former foreign minister, urges Benito Juarez to resign. He says, there's no way you will be able to defeat Maximilian backed by the French. We have to come to an accommodation. And look, Maximilian's liberal anyway. And Benito Juarez completely rejects it. So I think the opponent that he's dealing with that makes this difficult. The resistance is determined and heroic.
But for a brief while, I mean, a couple of years, things kind of go okay. You know, he brings in measures, he has them translated into Nahuatl. Language of the Aztecs and all this kind of stuff, and it's all ticking along, and then it all starts to crumble. And is that due to circumstances within Mexico, or is it the effect of the ending of the American Civil War, or
it's both
French politics, or
in fact all three? So the fact that Benito Juarez has been able to hold out for as long as he has and is undefeated is crucial. It buys him and the Republican forces in Mexico time that they need. And what they need desperately is more money, and they need resupply as well in terms of munitions. And they get that with the end of the American Civil War. During the American Civil War, there's an arms embargo. And as we said, Lincoln is desperate not to do anything to offend France, lest he might tip the balance in his own internal conflict. Once that's over, the arms embargo is lifted. Juaristas have access to guns, they have access to money, and they can begin to resupply. Also, crucially, what Washington can now do is pressure Napoleon III. And we can now start talking about the Monroe Doctrine without fear of any meaningful French reprisal, which is exactly what happens. It's Seward, William Seward, who is the Secretary of State, essentially by the end of 1865, gives Napoleon III an ultimatum: get your troops out of Mexico or it's war. At the same time, Maximilian, not least because of his penchant for orchestras and champagne and interior design and decoration and making all these wonderful residences, his government is bankrupt. So he writes to Napoleon III at the end of the 1865 as well and says, oh, by the way, the payments that we agreed to keep the French army in Mexico, I can't make them anymore. Obviously, we're friends, so it doesn't matter. Can you just cover it for me?
So that's looking bad. That's looking bad. And then Carlotta goes to Europe.
Right.
So she's been she's really loved being an empress. I mean, she's a great hostess. She's had an absolute ball. I mean, often literally.
Yeah. Often literally.
But she now goes back to Europe, and that's partly to kind of finesse things with Napoleon III.
But that's also right?
With the papacy.
She's already said to Maximilian, hasn't she, Tom, that you can't abdicate. You know, basically like Theodora with Justinian in the Byzantine Empire. You know, the purple is a great winding sheet or whatever.
Yeah.
I'd rather die an emperor than live as a slave.
But he agrees. A true Habsburg never leaves his post in the moment of danger. So she heads off to Europe and it goes badly wrong.
It does. So when Maximilian finds out that Napoleon III is going to abandon him, he does rather petulantly say, I'll abdicate if you don't want me here. Carlotta is furious and she says, no, absolutely, you must stay there, and convinces him exactly of what you say, Tom, that a Habsburg never leaves his post. So resolved to stay, she'll go to Paris and she'll persuade Napoleon III to change his mind. So she voyages over in the summer of 1866 and arrives in France. Now, I have a lot of sympathy. We've all been in this situation, haven't we, with Napoleon III. He does everything he can to avoid this meeting. No one likes to be reminded of their foreign policy mistakes. And so he says, I'm not feeling very well. And, wouldn't you rather speak to this person? And perhaps we can do it next
time. I've got COVID.
I'm isolating. Eventually, he's shamed into it. And Carlotta, as we said, you know, her favourite subjects are religion and classics. So she's done her homework. She's brought letters that Napoleon III had written to Maximilian saying, you know, my support will never fail you. Now, of course, earlier in the year, Napoleon III has announced publicly that his support has massively failed and that French troops are coming home. So Carlotta brings these letters out and puts them in front of Napoleon III, an incredibly dramatic meeting. And Napoleon III starts crying, but he doesn't change his mind.
It's such Gallic conduct. Yeah. I mean, it's like this podcast, the story of this podcast could have been written by Dr. Johnson or somebody.
And actually, there's a moment where a servant comes in and serves refreshments, and it slightly befuddles Carlotta. And then she sort of talks herself out of it. She says, I see what's happened. Your ministers are forcing you to do this. It's not your decision. Let me speak with them. I'll convince them and they'll convince you. And everybody says, absolutely. I will set up those meetings. You can have a whole suite of rooms to do them, whatever you want. And of course, you know, foreign policy is to preserve the emperor anyway, but his ministers never supported it in the first place. It's hugely unpopular in France. The decision stands, but Carlotta's got one trick left up her sleeve, which is to go to the Vatican and have a meeting with the Pope. Because as we said, Maximilian's liberal policies have alienated his core Catholic conservative constituency. But if they are backed by the Pope, then of course that brings the Catholics in Mexico on board. So there's still hope. She travels overland to Rome, arrives there, I think it's in September of 1866. Now, the first meeting goes relatively unproblematically. It's the second meeting where things begin to unravel, because the pressure is enormous. She's convinced her husband to stay in Mexico. The empire looks like it's falling apart, and this mission with the Pope is crucial. So she can't wait for it, and her health is beginning to suffer, and she demands to be driven to the Vatican. Unannounced, she breaks into the Vatican. I mean, how do you stop the Empress of Mexico if you're just on the door to let them through? Demands to see the Pope. Eventually, the Pope is sort of roused, presumably in his papal pyjamas. And sort of, you know, what's going on? In the corridors of the Vatican, confronted with the Empress of Mexico. And she breaks down, uncontrollable sobs, screaming. And what she's screaming is that Napoleon III is trying to murder her with poison. That her entire entourage that has come with her from Mexico, her servants, Mexican politicians, whoever they be, are in the pay of the French emperor and they're trying to have her killed. Now, of course, Napoleon III, I mean, you know, devious though he may be, has no interest in poisoning Carlotta, and she's lost her mind. is completely gone into a world of delusion and paranoia. And she sees Napoleon III as literally the devil incarnate, the principle of evil upon earth, she calls him. Now, this, of course, doesn't result in a concordat with the Pope, which will rally Catholic Mexico behind. So her mission is failed.
So actually, I said Dubois de Saligny was the worst diplomat of all time, but perhaps Carlotta has actually pipped him.
She's not achieved her mission. But I like the way that you were focused on that, Tom. You've been an excellent boss, sir. But did you? And the deal?
Yes. Did it come off?
It doesn't. She's actually taken into care by her Belgian family and put the equivalent of isolation, which is the way that people thought that best to deal with these mental problems in those days. And of course, it was the very opposite. She never recovers. And in fact, she never goes back to Mexico.
But meanwhile, Maximilian is stuck in Mexico and the sphere of his control is starting to shrink and collapse. And so he gets advised, doesn't he, to go to a place called Queretaro, is that right?
Queretaro, yes.
He's already had another flirtation with abdication, hasn't he, when he hears about Carlotta. Again, people say to him, other people say, oh, don't abdicate, you know, better to, you're a Habsburg, all this sort of stuff. And I think he packed packed his bags on that occasion?
This time. So once he hears the news that Carlotta has suffered this terrible incident and his wife is sick, he resolves to abdicate again, so second time. But we should have really emphasized about Maximilian. He's indecisive. He procrastinates. He doesn't like, well, if you don't have to make a decision, don't make it. Always push it.
But he is brave, right? I mean, he is very brave.
That comes across, absolutely. So he's talked out of it, as Dominic says. The conservative allies promise him everything, tens of thousands of men, tens of millions of dollars. Once the French have gone, we won't have the stigma of foreign intervention. Just think how we'll be able to defeat the Juaristas.
Yeah, without any soldiers, we'll be so popular.
But he does have some, doesn't he? I mean, he ends up going to this place Queretaro because there are, you know, this is a stronghold of conservatism. Yeah. And
so once the French have left, and you know, there's just all kinds of scenes reminiscent of more recent events where refugees following in the wake of the French army and sort of chaos and so on and so forth, and they desperately want Maximilian to come with them. He refuses to say, I'm going to stay and fight. And that's it. So the plan is to go to a town about 130 miles northwest of Mexico City, Queretaro. Now, this is an imperial stronghold. There are imperialista soldiers, the supporters of Maximilian imperialistas already there. And what's going to happen is, this is the plan as it stands. Maximilian will become commander-in-chief of the army. He will lead a small force out from Mexico City. They will march to the relief of these imperialistas. Three Juarista armies are converging on the city, but you defeat them one by one. And then the empire will be gloriously restored after this dramatic victory over the forces of the impious atheistic liberals. It sounds like a desperate plan, and it is one. Instead of the tens of thousands of men, the conservatives managed to scrape together 1,500 for Maximilian to lead northwards, and only $50,000, which is barely enough to pay the wages of the troops that he's marching to Queretaro with, rather than even to relieve that force.
And then he goes butterfly hunting.
Well, this is it. So, so Maximilian has never served in an army, let alone commanded one. He's appointed commander-in-chief with the idea that, you know, this victory will be his responsibility and therefore will demonstrate what a wonderful leader he is. Maximilian, he's I guess what one would call a dilettante, although he's interested in natural science and botany and especially butterflies. So it's a sort of fantastic moment. So the territory, his empire has shrunk to the point because while he's prevaricating about whether I should abdicate, the Juaristas are advancing on all sides and they're taking towns and cities and taunting the defenders, saying, well, your emperor's packed up, as Dominic says, your emperor's, you know, he's packed up his furniture. He's off. So what on earth are you fighting for? Plus, they haven't been paid in about a year either. So it's there's not really much support for him. It's melting away. And so the countryside is held by Juarista guerrilla forces. And so he's constantly under attack on this march. But he's always stopping off for sort of teachable moments about Aztec history that will inspire his troops. Or to look at a rare butterfly that he hasn't cataloged.
I mean, this is where it's very Gabriel García Márquez.
Yeah. I think that's how you would behave, Tom. Wouldn't it? I mean, you would see some sort of interesting fossil, or you know, you go on one of your walks and look at some old churches.
Well, I can tell you, I would have scarpered in his situation. I would absolutely have abdicated. And
there's a wonderful, wonderful moment as he's writing letters to his the director of a museum of natural science, which he's opened. He's a big fan of museums, so there's a lot to like with Maximilian there. And he's talking about the journey, and he really does focus on the butterflies. And he says, "But as the bullets were whistling around me, I noticed the most extraordinary butterfly."
It's admirable in a certain way.
He does show absolute cool, calm, and collected courage under fire, and he does show leadership abilities and charisma, and he does lead this horse safely to Querétaro.
But that then turns out to be as I understand it from your book, it's surrounded by heights. And his enemies are able to occupy the heights. And so basically he's stuck there.
Querétaro is the worst place to have a siege, surrounded by hills on three sides, open plain to the west. There's a beautiful 18th century aqueduct that brings water in. That's very quickly cut. The Juaristas take the high ground. And of course, the plan to defeat these armies one by one would require decisive action. And Maximilian prevaricates and it doesn't happen.
But even now he could still escape, right? Because somebody says to him, don't they, at some point, "You know, I've basically got a great plan for you to get away and get out of the town." But Maximilian says, "No, no, no, I've invited some local officials." What would they say if they arrived and I was gone? It would be very disrespectful and discourteous of me to leave.
Which, again, I think reflects very well on
Yes, him. Absolutely. I mean, manners are much more important than saving one's own life.
But anyway, so he ends up, and again, you have a fabulous sentence, "The Archduke Ferdinand Maximilian, born at the Habsburg Palace of Schönbrunn, offered his sword to Escovedo, a former farm labourer from the harsh sierras of Nuevo León," which again, it's kind of that, it's that conjunction of two totally alien worlds. And he becomes a prisoner, and things take a dark turn for him from that point on.
Yes, understated. The result is not good from his point of view. Yeah, the siege, it was a disaster. He's actually betrayed after 2 months by one of his most loyal officers, a man that he was godfather to children of, who goes over into Juarista lines, leads them through, and in the sort of morning of May 15th, 1867, the Juaristas have encircled the town and broken through the Imperialista lines, and he's put in prison, court-martialed, which is very much going to be a show trial. It's actually held in a theatre named after the first emperor of Mexico, Iturbide, and people who've been paying attention will remember that he was also executed.
I love the detail in your book where he says, I don't really think I want to have a trial. I'm an emperor. And they say, yeah, but kings have been tried before. Look at Louis XVI. And I can't imagine anything less reassuring.
I know, and that's from another French diplomat. It's a French diplomat. He desperately doesn't want to go. And she says, yes, but what about Marie Antoinette and Louis XVI? I mean, that was good for them. Charles I, interestingly, is an inspiration for him.
I was about to say, very much, is he a friend of the show, Charles I? He has an ambiguous relationship.
He does, I think. Yes,
but Ed, here's a question for you. Why do the Mexicans, why are they so set on trying him and executing him? Why don't they just put him on a boat and say, you know, bugger off back to Europe?
It's an excellent question. And Maximilian would have been fairly confident that that's what would have happened. Of course, it's something that he's offered to do. He says, I'll abdicate a go. I promise I won't come back. And if you think about, you know, the conflict you have in North America between Union Confederacy, Jefferson Davis, who's committed, you know, the most egregious treason you possibly could against the Union, right? He is put in prison, but he's eventually pardoned and amnestied or whatever it is. So that execution is rare. But Benito Juarez, as we said, is made of stern stuff. Now, this conflict in Mexico has been raging almost without interval since 1858. So that's nearly 10 years. And it's not, the fight is not with Maximilian, although, I mean, at this stage, of course it is, but it hadn't begun with Maximilian. It had been with the Conservative Party. Remember, it was defeated in civil war in 1861. And so the French sort of poured gasoline onto the burning embers of this conflict, which then flared up again. And, you know, tens of thousands of Mexicans have been killed. And Benito Juarez wants to end that conservative resistance to his legitimacy, I suppose, is the way of saying it. And of course, we focus on Maximilian, but he's executed alongside two other men, Miguel Miramón and Tomás Mejía. And these are both leaders of the Conservative Party representing different strands. Miramón, the sort of Creole landed aristocracy, descendants of Spaniards. Mejía, who is another indigenous peoples of Mexico, but that deep strand of pious rural conservatism based on Catholicism. And so you essentially, and Maximilian, of course, representing Europe and European monarchy and foreign intervention. And so it is an incredibly determined attempt to put an end to that kind of resistance.
And I suppose also to kind of offer, you know, serve as a warning to other European princelings who may be tempted to
yes.
pop over and have a crack.
Yeah. Because that monarchy, the idea of monarchy had just been bubbling below the surface in Mexico from the 1840s onwards. So this is what happens if you try and set up a monarchy in Mexico.
So Ed, he get together with the two conservatives, gets hauled in front of a firing squad. They get shot. He's not wearing a sombrero,
no,
as Manet shows him wearing. His body is treated quite disrespectfully, isn't it? They don't follow court etiquette. They keep the body in Mexico City, and then after the negotiations, it goes back to Vienna.
They don't follow court etiquette. Actually, it's worth pointing out that Maximilian wrote an emergency court etiquette to be observed during siege warfare conditions,
so while
artillery is raining down. He always had an eye for etiquette, which is not followed, as you say, after his death. So the body's embalmed. The idea it will be sent back to Vienna. Benito Juarez tries to use it as diplomatic leverage, essentially, to get Franz Joseph to recognize the Mexican Republic, because by executing Maximilian, Mexico does become something of a rogue state in European eyes for a good 10 years or so before any European court actually recognizes the Mexican Republic. And so the body is not treated well. It's kept in Mexico City in rather insalubrious conditions, and it's eventually sent back. I think it's November 1867, so a good few months after the execution.
So your book is The Last Emperor of Mexico. We've already said yet, but of course, you know, the likelihood that there'll be another emperor of Mexico is fairly low. So Mexico is a republic to this day. I think we should end just by asking a question from Thomas Henselick, which I was wondering as well. Is there still any remembrance of Maximilian amongst contemporary Mexicans, or has the episode been utterly forgotten? And what role does this episode play in the historical memory of Mexico?
It's not been forgotten at all. But of course, the celebration there is Benito Juarez and all things like Cinco de Mayo. So if you fly into Mexico City, you fly into Benito Juarez Airport. The role that it plays in Mexico in terms of its history is a foundational moment. Independence in the 19th century was contested, and depending on who you spoke to, they'll tell you a different story and about different heroes. The story of Benito Juarez's triumph over the forces of European imperialism, monarchy, and sort of reactionary Catholic conservatism becomes one that most Mexicans, if not all, are able to rally behind. And so it has a unique place in Mexican history, and therefore the story is well known. In terms of Maximilian's legacy, it does become quite romanticized, as you can imagine, with Carlotta and the court. And it's because, as you say, it's so exotic and so almost out of time, even in the 1860s, that it does become the focus of quite a lot of literature and film and things like that. So he's remembered very much as being on the wrong side of history, and Benito Juarez as being on the right side. But there is an element as well that his character does shine through in some of the things that he's sort of naive and unwelcome, but not perhaps irredeemable in and of himself, I think, is probably
now, how now talking of irredeemable, maybe we should end with the villain of the story. Because, I mean, he doesn't have long left himself, does he? Napoleon III, it looks like he sent this man to his doom and basically got away with it. But, I mean, his own imperial ambitions are about to collapse in ashes around him, aren't they, in, what, 1870, 71?
Well, one of Maximilian's last wishes, which he was that if he was able to go into exile, he would enroll in the Prussian army and fight against the French. And of course, that's exactly what happened. Well, except for the fact that he can't enroll in it. So he would have been delighted when Prussian troops streamed across the French border, and Napoleon III, who is sort of ironically trapped in a much larger version of what happened to Maximilian.
But he gets away, doesn't he, and ends up in Chislehurst.
Well, he very sensibly abdicates.
yes.
He says, I think the game might be up.
And Ed, you are currently, I think, writing a book about Napoleon III, which, based on the evidence of your wonderful book on Maximilian, is going to be so worth reading. I guess kind of grimly funny, as in so many ways this book is. Can't thank you enough. It's been an absolute tour de force. And just to reiterate, Edward Shawcross, The Last Emperor of Mexico, fantastic book. Rush out and buy it.
Cheers, thank you.
We should say, I guess, adios.
Adios and au revoir. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
Hi. I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.